I am sure that you have heard it, heard someone say, I cannot believe in God, or I can no longer believe in God because of the existence of, or the nature of, or the extent of suffering in this world. Certainly not belief in the God that Christians worship, you know, your God of love. How could such a God exist when hundreds, even thousands of people are wiped out by earthquakes and tsunamis? Where children die of leukemia? Where a virus takes hold and wipes out vulnerable people? Or where innocent women and children are blown to bits by bombs? Sometimes the objection is very personalized. I watched my mother die, her body wasting away with cancer. Or I had a cousin who died in a horrible car accident at the tender age of 17. If your God exists, where was he then? Certainly, he doesn't seem to care. How do we address such a roadblock to faith? What Tim Keller has called a defeater belief. And how can we possibly hope to transform this objection into a signpost to faith in the true and living God? We'll begin with some points of defense. Number one, there is much to the issue of suffering that we simply do not understand. And I think it is incredibly important that we begin by acknowledging the limits of our response to this roadblock. Indeed, this is arguably, I would say, the most difficult of the defeater beliefs that we will encounter in this series that we're doing. We need to tread sensitively, especially where someone has experienced deep personal suffering. The worst thing that we can do is to offer, you know, really glib answers. And surely it will be a lot more disarming if we confess that there are no easy solutions and we display sympathy for how difficult it can be for someone who has direct experience of tragedy to overcome their absence or their loss of faith. And this is particularly the case when, like me, we have actually known little or nothing of suffering and certainly outright tragedy in our own lives. So we begin by admitting that anything that we say on this issue is necessarily limited and won't resolve all the mystery and all the moral quandaries around this topic of suffering. So that's my first point. There is much about suffering that we just cannot give an answer to. Number two, the Bible is brutally honest about the reality of suffering. The Bible doesn't mask the existence of suffering. There's no attempt to whitewash it from its pages. Indeed, the Bible is full of it. Disasters, sickness, death, even genocide. And what is more, the Bible is honest in admitting that bad things often happen to good people. Indeed, it is the righteous who often suffer the most. Certainly, Jesus cannot be fairly accused of promising the absence of suffering. Did he not tell his followers, in this world you will have trouble? It's those who pervert the gospel, the peddlers of the so-called health and wealth prosperity gospel, who tell people otherwise. But their message is the inverse of biblical truth. So whatever else people say about God, they must allow that his word does not promise anything like freedom from suffering in this life. So that was my second point. The Bible is brutally honest about the reality of suffering. Point three, suffering is ultimately rooted in the fall. The Bible declares that when God made this world, he was pleased with his creation. Genesis 1:31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Creation then was originally perfect, but then the fall occurred. Man rebelled against his creator, and as punishment for his sin, creation was cursed by a holy God. Let me read to you a few verses from Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 to 19. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat of the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. This is the origin of decay, disease, disaster, and death. It's what sometimes we call natural evil. God is not responsible. It is the product of man's rebellion against the good order of things that God had created for man to enjoy. Had there been no rebellion by man, there would never have been decay, disease, disaster, or death. So point three, all suffering is rooted in the fall. Point four, God is not responsible for human evil. It's very convenient to blame God for all that is wrong with this world. But actually, a significant degree of suffering is the very direct result of the actions of mankind. Bombings, killings, child sex abuse, human trafficking, genocide. This is the responsibility of man. It is what we call, in distinction to natural evil, like your earthquakes or cancer, it's what we call moral evil. In some cases, moral evil is done in the name of religion. You know, atrocities committed by Islamist extremists, or even murder committed under the tagline of "For God and Ulster." But it's not the pure religion of the Bible, and certainly it does not carry the endorsement of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. Moreover, in a limited number of situations, illness can be the direct result of human wickedness as defined by the Bible. Some deaths from sexually transmitted disease or excessive consumption of alcohol, for example. God should never be made a scapegoat by those who refuse to face up to the reality of the innate sinfulness of man and the evil that resides in the human heart. Take the Holocaust, probably the worst example of suffering, the worst case of suffering endured so far by the human race. 6 million Jews exterminated, many in specially constructed gas chambers. This was not God's doing. It was the actions of depraved men. Yes, God could have stepped in and put an end to it, just as through his omnipotence, he could prevent any natural disaster like an earthquake from happening. But he certainly did not author it. And indeed, everything about him stands in opposition to such horrendous evil. So God is not to blame for human evil. And fifthly, all suffering is not without purpose. Sometimes suffering serves as a wake-up call. It reminds us of our frailty and the fact that this life will not go on forever. Our days are numbered, and the Bible warns that after death comes judgment. And thus, while some people react to the likes of earthquakes or terrorist atrocities by concluding that there can be no God, others are driven to God as they seek refuge or are shaken out of their complacency. It is also the case that sometimes suffering can be character forming. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. The Apostle James talks of how trials develop perseverance, chapter 1, verses 2 to 3. Is it not true that we are often amazed by the fortitude displayed by those experiencing suffering, especially those who are sustained by their faith in God, who are granted a special peace and strength as they undergo their trial or as they contemplate what lies beyond the grave? In some cases then, not all cases, but in some cases, we can see clearly that suffering has a purpose. It may force a person to sort of grow up, or it may be the only thing that forces some people to face up to eternal realities and to seek God while he may be found. So all suffering is not without purpose. We're going to leave then our defense, and we're now going to move to our counterattack. Once again, and particularly on this issue, there is the caveat that we need to move here with great sensitivity. But is there anything that we can say to turn the tables on the objector, to get him or her to see that actually the Christian faith offers more than the alternative of non-belief? So I have 4 points this time. Number one, atheism has nothing of hope to offer to the sufferer. Atheism has nothing of hope to offer to the sufferer. Rejecting the existence of God doesn't remove your suffering. All it does is remove all hope in your suffering. What can we say to the terminally ill child? Hard luck. You're the victim of random and mindless forces. Or how do we seek to comfort those who are caught up in some sort of natural disaster or terrorist atrocity? Wrong time, wrong place. Whereas the Bible holds out genuine hope, the very reversal of the fall, a new heaven and a new earth, atheism is bankrupt. The truth is that in respect of offering an answer to the problem of suffering, atheism leaves you in a worse place, a place of hopeless despair. Life is reduced to chance, some of good luck, some bad, tough if you're dealt a poor hand. End of story. Number two, God is on the side of the innocent or righteous sufferer. God is on the side of the innocent or righteous sufferer. The Bible always champions the poor and the needy, the immigrant, the social outcast, the sick and infirm, and the orphan. The Apostle James, for example, defines true religion as looking after orphans and widows in their distress, James 1, verse 27. Jesus made time for lepers, for beggars, for cripples. Moreover, God has promised that those of his people who suffer righteously will be rewarded accordingly. The Apostle Peter spoke of the salvation that awaits those who have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials, 1 Peter 1, verse 6. And in chapter 7 of the book of Revelation, we are given to see a picture of a great multitude in heaven, described as those who have come out of the great tribulation. That is, those who have paid the ultimate price of being martyred for their faith in Jesus Christ. The point is that the God of the Bible is a God of justice. There will be a day of reckoning, and those who have suffered righteously in this life are not going to be shortchanged in terms of eternal reward. Number three, the God of the Bible knows about suffering from personal experience. The God of the Bible knows about suffering from personal experience. The God of the Bible is not some remote bystander to humanity's suffering, nor is he unmoved by it. Think of the Lord Jesus, who shed tears at the death of his friend Lazarus and the heartache that Lazarus's death caused to Lazarus' sisters, Mary and Martha. But more than that, think of how God, both Father and Son, suffered with the events leading up to and climaxing in Jesus' death at Calvary. Listen to Jesus as he prays in the Garden of Gethsemane. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. See him sweat drops of blood as he contemplates the horror of Calvary. Hear his cry of desolation from the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? How it must have broken the Father's heart to hear that cry. And yet, for the sake of sinners like us, refused to give an answer. There would be no relief for Jesus from his suffering until he had fully experienced death and hell as the price of procuring your salvation and mine. This is not the actions of a distant, aloof, uncaring, unfeeling God. It is the very opposite. It is the actions of a God who has entered into the world of suffering to a degree that none of us will ever endure. A God whose very reason for becoming incarnate, becoming a human being, was so that he might suffer in our stead. A God who, as the prophet Isaiah tells us, was a man of sorrows familiar with suffering, who took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, who was pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. Finally, point four, we don't see the full picture. We are not given to see the full picture. Our minds are finite. God is infinite. And perhaps if we could see what lies in store for some of those who suffer in this life, we might assess things differently. The Apostle Paul does lead us in this direction. Despite himself suffering a multitude of hardships, including being beaten to within an inch of his life, he would write to the Christian community at Rome, "I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us." Romans 8, verse 18. Indeed, such was Paul's grasp of what the afterlife will bring, that he describes these present sufferings as light and momentary troubles, which are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17. How many of those who suffer in this life will, in a day to come, join with Paul in his assessment of this life's sufferings? Can we not bow before an omniscient God who knows the beginning from the end and trust him with the mysteries of suffering? Do I trust my finite and fallen mind, or do I trust the infinitely gracious and loving God of the Bible? Thus I conclude, there are no easy answers to the question of suffering, and it would be foolish and insensitive to claim otherwise. But faced with the alternative, I'm prepared to place my confidence and hope in the infinite God who has been revealed to us supremely at the cross as a God of sacrificial love. And can I just add a postscript? I speak as the coronavirus starts to impact the United Kingdom, having, of course, affected other parts of the world more severely. Are we going to blame God for this virus? Are we going to say that it shows that he doesn't care? Or do we recognize this as yet further evidence of the damage done to this creation by the fall? Another warning to man to awaken from his complacency and avail of the opportunity to know God's forgiveness. Anyone who is prepared to put their trust in the Lord Jesus Christ can face the future with confidence, knowing that their salvation is secure no matter what course this virus takes.